copyright criminals, why'd you decide to make this film?
Because I grew up in the 1980s listening to hip-hop and listening to actually like experimental sound collage as a kid. And then a few years later, a bunch of my favorite artists started getting sued. And it was the first time I ever thought about like collage or sampling as anything other than an aesthetic issue, and instead as a legal issue. And so basically I was an undergrad and I decided to go to graduate school to study how copyright impacts culture and creativity and music, and that eventually led to making the documentary. The documentary, Copyright Criminals, its title is based on a chapter from one of my books titled Copyright Criminals, and so I basically decided to turn the book chapter into a documentary, and I did it with a documentary partner, Ben Franzen, who added quite a bit to it.
You use the word collage in that answer. Do you see sampling as basically just being a musical version of a collage?
Yeah, I see sampling as being a musical version of collage. I mean, that's essentially what it is. And, you know, you can make really uninteresting, uncreative collages with other people's images in the visual collage world, or you can do really interesting, fantastic things like what Jasper Johns or other pop artists or the Dadaists did in the early 20th century. And so, yeah, I mean, it's just an extension of the collage tradition extended into the audio medium.
So why the fuss over it? Because I don't recall there being this much of a fuss over using visual images to create collages.
Yeah, I mean, people like Andy Warhol, who had like a significant profile, were actually sued for using other people's images in their collages. But I think the art world is a much more of a rarefied world as opposed to the commercial music industry. And so when you had, well, the collage tradition enter into or collide head-on with big business, that's when the lawsuits exploded. And so that's why you haven't heard much about lawsuits revolving around Dadaists or pop artists, visual collage artists, as opposed to hip-hop artists, because they were selling millions of records, or at least potentially selling millions of records.
You mentioned during your presentation, or at least I got this impression, that perhaps an album like Paul's Boutique or Fear of a Black Planet could not get made today because it's so heavily relies on samples. Mm-hmm. Is that true?
Yeah, and it's not just that they relied heavily on samples, but they used lots of samples within one song, like 20, 25, 30 different sound sources to create a particular song. And so those musicians like Chuck D from Public Enemy and others who I've talked to over the years in interviews, they've outright said we had to stop making the music the way we used to because it was administratively too difficult to track down all those copyright owners and also too financially burdensome to do so.
Who's raising the concerns about this? Is it other artists, or is it the corporations, the record companies that are making a stink out of this?
Yeah, it really wasn't until the late 80s, early 90s when hip-hop collage records, I still call it collage, entered into the mainstream. And so it was the companies, largely, that were filing the lawsuits. Especially in the early days of sampling, there were a lot of artists, like old-school artists, who were being sampled who were totally offended because this was this new technique. It was, no one had really thought about collage in the context of musical production. So it wasn't just corporations that were suing. A lot of artists either sued or were just very vocal about how they thought sampling was just an uncreative, awful endeavor.
Did some of those artists eventually come around and accept sampling?
Yeah, a lot of artists did come around, or at least they, once they started getting checks from, you know, sample clearance royalties, they came around. Others have still remained very, very outspoken about sampling. Prince, for one, hates sampling, and he just simply doesn't allow it, or when he does, he charges the most exorbitant rates you could possibly imagine so that those samples will never get cleared because the artist who wants to sample him gets scared away by the price.
What is the difference between sampling and imitating a sound?
So sampling, the way I'm defining it, is actually taking a sound recording and copying it. And then oftentimes what hip-hop artists would do is they would make changes to the sound, like the tonality of the original sound recording source. The difference between that and imitating, like basically someone copying a bass line, if you copy a bass line, it could still potentially be a copyright infringement. But if you copy the basic style of a bass line, imitate the basic vibe of a bass line or a guitar riff, that often puts you more in the clear in terms of it not being a copyright infringement. Whereas when you copy a sound recording itself, even if you transform the tone or even radically change the sound, in a lot of sampling copyright infringement court cases, there are expert witnesses who do what's called audio forensics to see whether or not the original sound source, even if it's been completely transformed, came from a particular sound recording. And if it did, then it is quite potentially a copyright infringement.
Did many of these albums give credit in the liner notes? I seem to remember reading liner notes that said the song includes samples from this, that, and the other thing.
The early days, like the 80s, rarely were samples credited. It really wasn't until after the lawsuit started happening that you started seeing samples being credited, sort of like a bibliography.
And who is doing the suing? Is it the record companies, or are they the ones who own the rights to these songs rather than the musicians who are actually being sampled?
Yeah, oftentimes what I found is musicians tend to be more reasonable when they're dealing with other musicians. And most of the time it's not the artists who are suing, it's the record companies which own the sound recording copyrights who are pulling the trigger. So, for instance, you know, George Clinton went on CNN with Chuck D and Flavor Flav from Public Enemy after they were sued for sampling his Parliament Funkadelic work, but he didn't own that work. And in fact, not only did he not own that work, he was also one of the people who was sued by the company that owns his work for sampling one of his own records from the 1970s. So he was sued for sampling himself. So that's a great example of how artists often don't own the rights to their own music.
Sued for using his own music, his own creation.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he was legally in the wrong for doing so because he did not own the sound recording copyright.
Did that cost him money eventually when he got sued?
Yeah, and I don't know how much. I'm sure he didn't discuss that with me, the number amount.
Copyright Criminals, was this a difficult film to make because of some of these issues?
Yeah, it was really difficult to make because it was basically a legal hot potato. A lot of film distributors, DVD distributors, broadcasters really liked the film, but they backed away from it because, they told us we like it, but we don't want to take on the risk, the legal risk. And fortunately, PBS got behind us, and, you know, we were able to claim fair use on a lot of our uses, brief quotations of songs that appear throughout the film. We're able to assert fair use, while at the same time we raised a substantial licensing budget to pay for song clearance rights as well when we were using more extensive uses of other people's songs.
Did your film end up raising any new copyright issues?
No, not yet. The only way it would raise a copyright issue would be in the realm of fair use, if someone decided to sue us and we would have to assert our fair use rights. And that's not a battle that I really want to deal with, because from interviewing people who have been sued for copyright infringement, I know how time-consuming and psychically draining it can be to be involved in a lawsuit. And financially draining, for that matter.
It is out there now, YouTube, Netflix, Amazon, you can buy it. So
Hulu, anything, yeah. It's all over the place.
So what's the response now that it's out there for anyone to see?
Well, we've gotten a really good response. I mean, of course there are people who are, nitpicky because we didn't include X artist or Y artist, but that had a lot to do with just who we had access to at the time and our budget, travel budget, to get to see people. Also, it was just a one-hour documentary, so we weren't able to cover everything. That's why I write books about the subject also, so I get to expand on the topics. But yeah, I mean, from a number of artists who appeared in the film have gotten back to us and said they really liked it.
Clyde Stubblefield, one of them, is he sort of a main character in the movie, if you will?
Yeah, he's a main character, and he really liked the film. We brought him to the Toronto International Film Festival, its premiere, and he was overwhelmed with the response. Especially that moment in the documentary when there's a montage of all the different hip-hop songs that had sampled him. He had never heard those songs, and he said something along the lines of, "Holy fill in the blank." Yeah, but it wasn't like he was mad about it. He was really taken aback and kind of honored that his music had that reach.
And it sounds like even though he certainly would appreciate compensation, what he really wants is recognition for what he created.
Yeah, and this was, I mean, to my knowledge, the first time Clyde had been featured in a high-profile documentary like this. So, yeah.
Is he the most sampled drummer in hip-hop?
Arguably, although there's another key sample. There are a number of people who can make that claim, but I'd say that Clyde Stubblefield is probably the most sampled artist just in general, because his music, also his drumming, has been sampled in pop songs and in R&B songs, and dance songs.
I'd always heard John Bonham's opening drum to the drum part to When the Levee Breaks was one of the most heavily sampled, or is the most heavily sampled.
That was sampled fairly early on. Like, there's a Beastie Boys track that samples it, but because Led Zeppelin is so litigious, a lot of people backed away from sampling that very recognizable John Bonham drum beat.
They're very protective of their music for a group that allowed it to be used for an Oldsmobile or Cadillac commercial or whatever.
Well, not just that. They're very protective of their music for a group that's, especially in the first two or three albums, four albums, heavily lifted from other blues artists, African-American artists. So that's pretty big irony there.
Yeah. Anything you want to add?
No. Thanks so much for the interview, and it was enjoyable talking to you.
Hey, thanks for talking to me. I appreciate it.